The United States in March banned laptops on flights to the United States originating at 10 airports in 8 countries, including Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and Turkey, to address fears that bombs could be concealed in electronic devices taken aboard aircraft. Britain quickly followed suit with a similar set of restrictions. The decision not to impose new laptop restrictions eases U.S. and European airlines' concerns that expanding the ban in Europe or other locations could cause major logistical problems and deter travel. Well, that's the latest, or some of the latest, having to do with airport security. And we'll be looking at the big picture of the development of airport security over the course of time, and perhaps a glimpse into the future, too. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. My guest is Laura Albert, professor of industrial and systems engineering at the UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you for having me.
It occurs to me a person would have to be 50 years old or older to remember what it's like just to walk onto a commercial airliner.
I certainly do not remember that. there was security in place by the time I was born.
So this has been going on for a long time, and it seems to me, of course, I don't remember it at all either, but it seems to me that it all started with hijackings to Cuba.
It did. One of those hijackings got a lot of airtime on TV. It was just traveling theater. It caught everybody's attention, and they became like a social contagion. They became a thing. And airline hijackings really skyrocketed, particularly to Cuba in the late 60s. And there's really no security before then. About 1970, there were some changes, but they were a little bit invisible to the passengers. There might be surveillance at airports, so you're not really going through security yourself. And that, as you might guess, did not affect the hijackings. They continued to be rather popular. And in 1972, kind of everything changed. And that's when we see like the magnometer and metal detectors being used to screen passengers. And also, I think some federal air marshals occurred in this time between 1970 and 1972.
But the Cuba situation was pretty much over by then, wasn't it? What prompted these changes in the early 70s?
It did. Well, because the hijackings persisted through 1972. And that's the aviation security that I knew. That really continued until the 90s and really almost to about 2001. And that seemed very free to just have to go through a metal detector. But I will say there was a great New Yorker cartoon that happened in 1972 just before this. And it was just this political cartoon about how everybody felt so naked with just that minimal level of security. And now it seems kind of funny to us that we thought that could be high security.
In a way, it seems you have to admire, respect the extent to which airport security has worked in this country. And on the other hand, of course, it's easy to complain about having to take your shoes off or having to go through any number of other procedures, which seem to change almost weekly. It seems like it would be impossible to screen every person who goes on to a plane. If you can't do that, what is the goal of airport security?
That's a great point. There's a couple goals. One, you want to actually prevent bad things from happening. The second you talked about was just the logistics. You want to get people through quickly. The TSA has a goal that they want to get everybody through the passenger screening in under 10 minutes. We just won't tolerate really long lines. It would affect our economy. It would really be devastating. I mean, these screening everybody and knowing exactly what they're carrying is achievable, but not desirable in any way. So you're really looking at cost and security, but also privacy. The more they look, the more we feel exposed and naked, if you will, going through security. And that's that is a criteria.
And the less we would want to fly.
Right. But I would say the goal is not to eliminate the risk. It's to reduce it as much as possible. And that's the way I look at it as a researcher.
And I mean, it's rather intriguing if you even scratch the surface of some of this thinking behind airport security. It makes perfect sense when you think about it, but to find out all the number crunching that's involved and the statistics and the probability of this happening or that happening if you mm-hmm. take certain actions. It's become almost an industry in itself.
That's true. And I'm certainly a number cruncher that builds mathematical models and optimization models to really look at how we can get the most bang for our buck. It is a cost-constrained environment. We spend a lot on aviation security, but we have limits. And we have all these limited resources. If you've been in an airport, they get busy. And we've all seen the line get really, really long, and we have to prepare for that. And we also have to actually build the technology, and that's not something I do. I figure out what we do with it. But the technology sometimes lags our actual need for it.
Well, in a sense, it's a moving target because the people who would want to cause harm to an airplane and its passengers are constantly changing their technology.
That's true. So definitely we have to evolve to the threat, but also public opinion about what we're willing to tolerate is also a moving target, and that is also part of the equation.
And so it's a constant balancing act, but with the rules changing all the time.
Yeah, well, as an engineer, I like to tinker with systems and constantly improve them. So I kind of like having a moving target.
Oh, and how does the fact that you're an engineer and a number cruncher tie in with the actual hardware? You said that you let other people develop that and then you determine how to use it. So as an engineer, how do you employ that information?
Oh, sure. So if you're developing a device, it's sort of there by itself, right? And I look at the bigger system and I look at all these people moving around through the country on airplanes and coming to the airport and arrival patterns. And if you just develop the technology and the device, it doesn't really tell you anything about that bigger picture of the logistics or the traveling of people and goods. And so I really design efficient and effective systems. And technology is a part of that.
So by systems, you mean kind of procedures just for handling the crowds that go through these systems?
Exactly. How many passengers could be considered high risk? What is the impact of transferring passengers? What's the impact of TSA pre-check if people move into different lines?
And so how can you determine what the risks are? How many people on that plane are, or potentially on that plane, are people that you don't want to let on? How can you crunch a number like that?
It's pretty tricky, and there's a lot of different systems involved. And I should first say that these risks are really, really rare. We hope that they're really rare, unlike risks in other domains. And also, we don't always have the numbers if you're studying this in the public domain, but we have an idea for what the risk profiles would look like. And we can look at really how to target the resources we have. And we can look at that in terms of throughput or how many passengers per hour that they can be handled, look at arrival patterns of the existing flights, and try to match passengers to the right level of resources to the best of our abilities. And then draw conclusions from that and how it should inform policy and how it should inform the design of risk-based systems and whether or not TSA PreCheck is worthwhile. And I think it is. I should say I have TSA PreCheck.
As long as we're on TSA PreCheck for a minute. I guess there are two ways to get it. One is there are various windows of opportunity when you can sign up for it and at one point at least pay for it.
Correct.
But also it is assigned, I believe, independently of that at what appears to be maybe not totally random, but a rather mysterious process.
That is true. So I recently got TSA PreCheck as part of Global Entry, but I was also receiving this mysterious, the beneficiary of this mysterious process. And they do a risk assessment. The airlines can do a risk assessment. And part of that is actually utilizing the resources. So when PreCheck was just beginning, there were not many passengers, but we had these dedicated lanes. And part of the goal was to switch the lowest risk passengers into these lanes to reduce the burden, the screening burden, and make those lines shorter for everybody else. And that's the idea with TSA PreCheck. You're trying to do less screening on the lowest risk passengers. I don't know exactly how that mysterious process works, but part of that is that airlines can move some passengers over at certain times into the pre-check lanes, and it comes on your boarding pass.
Right. So that's at the discretion of the airline as to who becomes eligible during any given flight for TSA PreCheck.
Correct.
And how do they determine who's a low-risk passenger?
That is also evolved. So we knew a little bit on September 11th, and the system is much more sophisticated now. It has a name. There's an acronym. Of course, there's an acronym, and then there's a government process. It's DARMS, the Dynamic Aviation Risk Management System. And it looks at a number of, you know, we have a lot of information about people. Some of it's kind of naive. They know where you're flying because you bought a ticket and how you paid for it. But they also try to track identities. And that's one of the things that has gone over time. If you have a common name, sometimes it's harder to be sure that you're really low risk because you have the same name as somebody who we're pretty sure might be a bad guy or has a record. So that there's a lot of information that they use based on your name, your history, your payment information, and your past travel history.
That implies that the more I travel and behave myself, the more likely I am to get a TSA pre-check?
You know, that's one of the things we do in engineering and a lot of other fields is we're trying to draw conclusions and ultimately design systems with data. But the more you know, usually the more that helps you make better decisions. And in this case, it makes you more certain that the passenger really is low risk. I mean, it's hard to know if a passenger is low risk without much information.
Sure. I mean, it seems looking at the dark side of it that a potentially harmful passenger would then kind of conform to all of these, criteria that would enable him or her to slide through the system.
That is exactly true. Would-be terrorists could definitely try to follow the rules the best they can. And that's always a challenge. And that's why the system needs to be dynamic.
Well, let's get a little bit into the way it has evolved over the course of time, because those of us who have done a fair amount of flying over the years, we kind of lose track of what happened when, along the way. There, as you implied, Laura, really was no screening at all prior to about 1968, and then in 72 in response to the kind of a spate of what seemed to be imitation hijacking mm-hmm. Attempts to Cuba mostly ramped things up a little bit, but then that seems to have gotten quiet for a while.
That's true. So I was born after 1972, but that was the aviation security I knew until I was an adult, really, when September 11th happened. There was a change that many people are not aware of that happened in the 90s that's worth discussing, because that was really the foundation that we had to work with when September 11th happened. And it really happened after TWA Flight 800. That plane crashed in, I think, 1996. And it was believed that, or it was suspected that that could have been a bomb, and it wasn't. But after that and earlier Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988, that one, a bomb did explode in the plane.
Well, was that the Lockerbie?
Lockerbie one.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That was traced to Libya.
Yes. And somebody checked a bag and left it in the plane, and that passenger did not get on the plane. And so in Europe, they actually would take those bags off after that. But the United States, we thought that would take too long, and that would affect our, flight and the economy, and so we left those bags in. But after 1996, we revisited that issue. It was actually Al Gore, who was kind of a visionary in aviation security, in addition to climate change and inventing the internet. But he really did have a vision for aviation security, but it was focused on checked bags, and because of the Pan Am Flight 103. And so they proposed what they called positive passenger baggage matching, where you'd pull a bag off, and that the airlines did not approve of that change.
How does that work?
That's where they would take the bag off if a passenger
if you
is
weren't
not
on the plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and most of the time, it's somebody just misses a connection, but their bag is there.
Well, and we've of course since experienced the phenomenon of the suicidal saboteur anyway.
Exactly, exactly. But as far as I know, we are doing positive passenger baggage matching. But what Al Gore did is he actually introduced screening of these bags for explosives. And they had been doing this in Europe, but they started screening only at the major hub airports some high-risk passenger checked bags for explosives. So it was about 5% of these highest-risk passengers at these hub airports. You know, how do you define high risk? Some of it might be that we just don't know a lot of information about you, but if we did, you'd probably be low risk.
How about high risk in relation to the place? In other words, Madison, Wisconsin, or Ottumwa, Iowa, probably less tempting target for a terrorist than New York or Paris?
It could be. The rules are classified. We know a little bit about what made people high risk. It was pain and cash in one-way flights. So there's been some speculation about how many of the 19 hijackers on September 11th were classified. They were called selectees and not high risk. And, you know, it's between 6 and 14, probably on the higher end of that. So not all of them, but way better than random. So if we randomly picked 5% of those terrorists, that would be about one of them. But it was sort of irrelevant because the hijackers didn't have checked bags, right? So that's one of the conclusions that we should look at. We were just screening checked bags for explosives. And the technology, it was kind of interesting. And we ended up seeing these machines in airports lobbies after September 11th. But they'd be sort of in the background in the late 90s. And they're these 9-ton machines. And they do all this imaging to look for possible explosives in the bags, mainly through imaging.
So There's two screenings going on there. There's the luggage you've checked, mm-hmm. and then there's the carry-on.
Right. So the carry-on was completely unaffected.
It wasn't screened?
Well, it was still in the same procedure mm-hmm. being used since the 70s.
So not very thoroughly at this point. Was any explosive ever traced to carry-on luggage?
Over what time period?
Well, in this time, you know, yeah. the 90s in particular or post 9/11?
That is a good question. I mean, there's always a lot of false alarms with these machines, an incredible amount of false alarms. I'm not sure exactly if they publicized finding anything.
I mean, we had the shoe bomb, of course, which fortunately was a failure.
Right. But we weren't looking for explosives on people or their carry-on bags for quite a while. I mean, there's a need for it, but there wasn't always a technology to do it quickly.
So let's, again, get to that balance between serving the customer and making him or her safe.
Exactly.
Was the next trend, then, speaking of shoes, when the shoe bomber or would-be shoe bomber turned up and now suddenly everybody has to take off their shoes?
Yes, there's a lot of knee-jerk reactions in aviation security, for sure, and that we still take our shoes off.
Unless you have TSA pre-check.
Yep.
What about then this whole business of powder and possibly explosives linked to powder? How do we look at that?
Oh, right. Well, there's powder. There's also the liquid restrictions was
sure,
a big one
sure.
that happened in 2006. And, it was really, really challenging. And this was all in an era where I should say something about the security. Security did change a lot after September
yes.
1st. We didn't necessarily have a lot of extra screening, but there was a requirement to screen all checked bags for explosives. And I mentioned these 9-ton machines. Well, two manufacturers made them. You can't just install them at airports overnight. So they had took a while to be manufactured and deployed. And you can't just put a bunch in airports because they're heavy. Airports can't support that many 9-ton screening machines.
Because you need one for every security point.
You do, and possibly many because the throughput was pretty slow. At this time, you had to manually put the bags in. It wasn't in line with the conveyor belts as it is now. And so then they had this army of TSA agents that would open the bags up. This comes back to the privacy issue and swab the inside. And so that uses a different technology, but to also screen for explosives.
And they, I think, still do occasionally put a slip in your suitcase
yes,
that says
do.
we've checked this out.
So you're saying that your bag gets checked a little extra? No, yes, they definitely do that. And so they've done that on a much more limited basis as the technology has improved and airports have all these conveyor belts to do the screening more automatically and less manually. So it's always evolving.
Maybe it is a security issue too. Dogs in airports? I mean, I know somebody who was actually I'm going to say fingered, although it was actually a paw, mm-hmm. by a dog who was working for, you know, security, airport security. And he was, in this case, sniffing out tulip bulbs.
Oh, right.
That were illegal to bring back from Holland. So have dogs played a role at all in, like, sniffing out explosives or contraband?
Absolutely. Dogs and canine units have really grown since September 11th. It's there's many, many layers. So if you can get by security, you might not get by the dog that might be hanging around the airport.
Did the pat-downs start with 9/11?
Yes, they absolutely did. And what's very interesting is that different airports did it really differently. And eventually, you know, they all started doing the pat-downs a much better way, I would say, much more uniformly. Many fewer complaints about the pat-downs than we used to have.
Did they have to do that by gender?
Again, it was handled, I think quickly they learned by gender, but it was not. At the beginning, it was a little bit of the Wild West at some of these airports. I remember flying and just like, you know, like the Denver, maybe it was Denver. It was just, they were very serious about the pat down there and not so much in other airports.
I flew into and out of Boston 3 weeks after 9/11, and that was the first one I got. It was a very polite pat down. And I think it was, if I remember right, it was a young woman who, you know, asked permission and was rather perfunctory about it. But we're going to look further at airport security, the evolution of airport security, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Laura Albert. We're talking about the evolution of airport security, which has been going on for just about 50 years now. It's hard to believe, but it has started and stopped a time or two, it would seem, over the course of the years. And as we get into, of course, the post-9/11 era, airport security very much a factor in all of our travels, and that would include the increased presence of armed personnel in airports, wouldn't it?
That would. There's many layers to security, and having people there that are just observing helps.
Have there been any incidents in airports that would require? There have been a couple, haven't there, in this country that have required intervention by armed security personnel in airports?
Oh, sure. And there's probably a lot of smaller ones that we never hear about that don't make the paper. What the TSA has been great about is doing behavioral research and increasing this. This is what they do in Israel, and it's actually pretty helpful. The way I like to think about it is that when you go through the metal detector, your bag gets screened, they're really trying to find bad things in your bags.
Sure.
They do this with the liquids. I always leave a water bottle in my bag, and they scold me and take it away. But the point of security really isn't to take our water bottles away that we've accidentally left, these banned items. You really want to prevent bad people from getting on the plane and causing destruction. And so that's where some of the behavioral profiling probably isn't the right word, but the behavioral detection officers that are really trained, and it takes a lot of training to just identify, you know, something that doesn't quite look right, and then you can look at it a little bit closer. And so that's where having some extra people and these extra layers just in the airports can add a lot of value.
Well, there seem to be two components to that, Laura, at least the way you're describing it. One would be observing the people, and then the other would be studying what they're actually carrying through. How has airport security gotten more sophisticated in terms of judging the people themselves just by observing them?
Well, it probably hasn't been very well. I mean, I think this is pretty new in our history. And if you look at the past 50 years, it's really been focused on the items that we shouldn't be carrying on. And I used to enjoy reading the TSA's blog about where they'd show pictures of everything that they'd accidentally find. You know, in some states, people accidentally bring their gun with through security because it's just always there. And it is kind of frightening, some of the things that they find. I'm glad they're not on the plane. But at the end of the day, I'd be more secure, feel more secure knowing that they're finding the bad people. And I think this warrants some discussion because if you look on September 11th, those hijackers did not bring items that were banned. They brought box cutters because they, you know, there's nothing that they could really do. And that security checkpoint at to really stop those attacks. And so the security checkpoint is really, really critical for keeping us safe, but it's not the end-all be-all. We need these extra layers.
Were the box cutters actually the way they got control of that plane?
You know, I don't know if we know a whole lot of detail except for the one flight where people were calling back with some information.
Right.
But the short blades, I think most people were thinking these hijacking attempts to Cuba, you just cooperate. And so we suspect that it was pretty easy to hijack the first three planes.
Well, something we haven't gotten into yet, and that is the whole redesign of the cockpit to make it less accessible to unauthorized personnel, and then training of the pilots, too. Do you have a sense of how that's changed since 9/11?
I think it's great. As a systems person, I think the more layers and the more obstacles you can have for anybody having a successful attack, if you have more layers between them and their goal, then that's good for security. And so all of those things that we do, reinforcing the cockpit doors, maybe having some weapons that the pilot can use, the pilot training, those are all additional layers. And together, you know, in the worst case scenario, we hope something keeps us safe. And passengers are part of that too. The shoe bomber got really close to being successful, but all the passengers on board were basically air marshals and together prevented an attack. We don't want it to get that close, but those other layers make a difference, and we've seen that in some of these incidents.
And it seems to have worked. I mean, I'm trying to remember when the last sabotage of an American plane would have been.
That's true. It does seem to have worked. Even if we don't always detect all the bad items, sometimes it deters or it just, you know, delays an attack because it causes would-be terrorists to have to do extra planning and spend extra time. And that's all good. If we can push those attacks way off into the future, hopefully they'll never arrive.
So what would be the kind of the frontier in terms of this, either the number crunching or the technology? Again, we have to, of course, keep two steps ahead of the would-be terrorists.
Well, I think behavioral detection, I think, offers possibly a lot of impact. For years, I had been talking about risk-based security and doing risk-based security and actually doing less security. And so I think we started along that path, and I think that's been good. But it took about a decade, really, for that to happen. So I think hopefully more of this is good. And I want to talk about that because it makes sense in the TSA paradigm where you have limited resources and you have to use them wisely. And so actually, if you really want to target resources at the riskiest parts of the system, one way to achieve that is to target fewer resources at less risky parts of the system. And in 2012, seniors and children had less security. Seniors didn't have to take off their jackets, and children don't have to take off shoes. And all those things just free up time for people to do more screening elsewhere. Also, a few years ago, the airlines, not entirely, but for the most part, stopped asking those two questions about have your bags always been in, you know.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And the reason why is because, you know, it never helped them find anything. People always told them the same answers.
Sure.
I was actually asked those on the way back from Amsterdam recently. So they're still being asked, but it just took a few seconds with every single passenger.
And you multiply look at, that
yes,
out.
By almost a billion passengers a year. It's a lot of time that's not spent wisely. And so if you think about it systematically, like that's a big piece of the puzzle. And so doing better security, part of the answer is actually strategically doing less security in other places. And I think that frontier is still worth exploring a bit.
And what about the body scans, though? I mean, it's a sort of a strange scan where, of course, you're insured that it's not really impinging upon your privacy, but and yet you're up there. It's kind of like the airport is one of those few places where you're guilty until proven innocent.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, the imaging received a lot of discussion, and I think I'm happy where it ended up. The images were, I mean, pretty graphic initially and also could be saved. And so this is somewhere if you're an engineer and you look actually at how they're doing the technology and what's being implemented and what's being stored where, these are all technical details that the public really needs to understand and be okay with. And we decided we were not okay with some of those solutions. But the imaging is cleansed, and so they see like a cartoon version of you now. And there is no storage of the original image of you, which I'm relieved about. And I don't remember the exact rules on storing them, but initially there were some changes made there. And I think one of the manufacturers, the way they actually constructed the actual technology is that there was a place in there where one of the images, I think it was the raw image, was kept somewhere. And they actually had to really scrap that manufacturer, unfortunately. They couldn't really just easily replace that technology. So it took a few years to get the scanners out. They seem to work pretty well. If you look at the throughput, that's always an issue when you introduce new technology. Sometimes the throughput isn't exactly what we'd see in a closed laboratory setting, and it can be hard to get people through.
So you don't always have to do that, do you? I mean, doesn't it vary according to what airport you're at? I'm trying to remember. It seems to me in some of the smaller airports in particular, you just walk through the scan, the metal detector.
I think they have them almost everywhere.
Do they?
They should be everywhere now. But that's another good point, is whenever you introduce a new technology, it takes years before it's everywhere. And so we're constantly in flux, even when the plan is to have a uniform policy everywhere. It takes a few years. And then we have to design that transition pretty intelligently. They do have the walkthrough because certain people, and such as pregnant passengers, go through the metal detector and not through the imaging. And I think some people can opt out and do the regular metal detector. So they need them there.
Who actually pays for all this technology?
Well, it's a good use of our taxpayer dollars, but there's also a security fee when you purchase tickets. I think it's like, it used to be $250 a flight segment. I haven't checked
the latest
amount.
That's part of the ticket.
Yes.
It's kind of a security fee for airport enhancement.
Yep. And the original airport enhancements in the 90s, well, those weren't the original ones, but the ones in the 90s were really developed by Northwest Airlines. So they've been very airline-driven, which is interesting.
Yeah, I was going to ask about what's the relationship between the airlines and the TSA.
Yeah, I mean, the airlines at the end of the day implement a lot. So it was a big deal after September 11th having these federal screeners. And, we should have federal screeners, perhaps, and not outsource this. And I mean, that's, again, if you're looking at
loopholes. Was that proposed?
Well, they were not federal screeners before September 11th. And so that introduces possible, loopholes.
Sure.
And possibly security
inconsistencies.
Issues.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, that's one of the issues that could come about.
So it has been proposed that they, they're currently not federal employees, or has that been changed?
Oh, they became federal employees, I think, that right after September 11th. So that was something that had changed.
But is there then a movement to privatize it?
There might be. I'm not aware.
Well, and, as time continues, then screening in the airport, is it actually faster than it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago?
I hope it is. It seems like it is. the pre-check lanes are pretty fast, I will tell you that. But yeah, no, there are a lot of efficiencies in the airport. I mentioned the checked bags has gotten much more efficient. We don't see that. It's all behind the scenes. But you can go on YouTube and watch videos of these conveyor belts, and it's a beautiful thing. It's beautiful to me just seeing these bags moved, and when an alarm gets triggered, the bag goes and they have to inspect it again somehow. So some things have really, really improved. 5 years ago, we still had the explosive trace portals. I think there are efficiencies there. And I think people are used to it, too. So without doing anything, people get used to the procedure,
True.
And they take their belt off without being prompted a lot of the time. And that all of that helps, actually.
It's always easy to forget the pocket change or something, though, and slow down the system.
It is definitely possible to do that. But if you actually look at what really makes the line get longer, it's having more passengers. We definitely have
Sure.
a lot of people flying. Slower screening. So that has actually gotten better. So every little bit you can improve with the average time it takes to screen somebody that can sometimes, in very busy airports, that makes a huge difference in the line. You think that couple of seconds doesn't matter, but if everybody's a couple of seconds faster, it really helps. And of course, having more screening lanes makes things shorter.
And why is it 3.4 ounces for liquids?
Oh, I forget that. That was a decade ago. But yeah, I think they were looking at really what's a trivial amount of liquid where you really couldn't
create
an explosive device. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, so, I mean, that's still, it's roughly that, isn't it? I mean, you can't just walk through with a water bottle.
It has to be an empty water bottle.
Right.
Yeah. I do that, and they do not get upset with me when I do that.
And that would be the same even if, say, it's a sealed bottle of alcohol?
As far as I know, it has to all fit. All of your liquids have mm-hmm. to fit in that 1 liter bag. So, again, you couldn't have many, many small bottles of explosives that you could then combine together after security.
So
that's
I'm,
the rationale.
If I'm in Japan, say, and a friend wants to give me a parting gift of a nice bottle of sake or something like that.
Check your bag.
It's okay if you check it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me, Laura, that the airlines are going to have slightly different priorities maybe than the TSA would, and because they have this whole customer service thing that they have to preserve and keeping the flyers happy, whereas, of course, the TSA has to be fixated on the absolute safety part of it. So are there places where the two kind of collide?
They do collide. Looking at the screening, there was a lot of resistance before September 11th to even do the checked bag screening. And as mentioned earlier with the positive passenger baggage matching, that cost is really borne by the airlines. And they do bear some of these costs, not always with checkpoint screening, but if you had to manually pull bags off of a flight, check bags off of a flight because a passenger isn't there, well, the airlines are really going to pay for that. And there just was absolute resistance before September 11th to do that. Even a report in a journal in my discipline showed that it would be very cost effective to do so. It's not just the cost of actually the manual cost of manually pulling these bags. It's the fact that these planes would be late.
Yeah.
Passengers can miss their connections. You look at all these issues, and those are the issues that the airline is are really worried about. Once passengers miss connections, that creates many other costs on
the system.
Yeah.
The system's
very fragile.
You might have to put them up or some kind of make good on another airline or something like that.
Exactly.
And so the way it is now, if I check my bags and then somehow miss my plane, those bags stay on the plane or do they come off?
They should come off.
And so that procedure requires then people on the plane to do the head count and all that and figure out who's missing, find those bags and take them off.
Exactly. Now, the head count part is pretty easy. When they scan the bags, they can figure out if somebody's not there and if they have a bag. But it does take time to manually find that bag in the plane.
Is that a count, do you think, for a fair number of late departures?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons a plane can be late.
The mechanical ones, of course.
Yes.
We're going to look further at flying and maybe the most efficient way for you to do it and to get through the system in a fast, friendly way when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Laura Albert, and she is telling us about the development, the evolution of airport security and the whole phenomenon of getting through an airport and onto a plane as efficiently and safely as possible. Getting onto the plane seems to be always a bit of a fiasco. Because no matter how they load the thing, you've got the Southwest Airlines model where there's these big zones of people and there's no assigned seat other than in your zone and everybody just kind of charges and ends up kind of willy-nilly. And then you have the more conventional way of a specific ticket for a specific seat. And how does all that actually work? I mean, is there really an efficient way to get people onto and off of an airplane?
Well, it always takes time to get people on an airplane, that's for sure. People have looked at that. I mean, it used to be kind of the back to front, more or less. I mean, you always have the priority passengers that get aboard first. That's their benefit. But what happens if you load from back to front is that everybody's waiting to get to the back. And so you're basically getting like one person at a seat at a time and everybody's stuck in line. And that's the advantage of the Southwest model is people hate waiting. And so they'll just sort of fill the seat. If they find a seat, they'll sort of fill it. And so people can just become a little bit more efficient. There are a number of simulations that people have done. And so one way to do it is sort of-ish back to front, but really it's outside to inside, maybe every other row. And so the idea is that if you look at the length of the plane down the aisle, if you can have somebody putting a bag in the overhead and getting in the seat, and many people doing that at once along that aisle, that's the most efficient way to do it. And so that's what the Southwest passengers, to some extent, will do. And then you run out of seats, and then it gets tricky at the end.
In my experience, what they do is they do outside and then aisle. And so you're going down, if you're like in, say, the B section or even the C section of the plane, you have an A and a C seat filled and all these middle seats that people have to climb over to, you know, people to get to.
Ultimately, that last step is pretty inefficient, isn't it?
Yeah.
And finding space in the overhead bin is one of those things that is making the process so difficult. So many people, including myself, like to bring their bag onto the plane and find a spot. And there's less and less space in the overhead bins for that. And this has become a big issue because most airlines charge fees to check bags. So people used to check bags quite regularly, and now much less so. And that has actually really impacted the time to board an airplane.
Because more people are carrying on.
Right. And that also affects the security lines because that is that just leads to many more bags and many more items to be screened.
Is it just the fee that has dissuaded people from checking their bags?
That's a big part of it. We've seen some of these changes that have happened almost overnight. And once airlines start charging fees, that really affects things. We saw that after the liquid ban restriction. Well, people put all the liquids in their bags and we check them.
Right.
And so overnight, we had so many more bags that were being checked, and it led to all these bottlenecks in the system, and lost bags skyrocketed. There's actually the FAA keeps data on that, and the lost bags did skyrocket. I mean, they eventually find them, but they don't make it with that passenger onto their next flight.
Do you have any sense at all that when you have these big bottlenecks or long lines in security, that it at all compromises the process by rushing it through, or is it going to take as much time for each person no matter what?
We definitely run the risk if they do rush through the process, it could possibly be an issue. You'd really rather have a screener really focus. If you're looking at scanning a bag by a machine, it's probably going to scan the same way, especially with these screens, machines that do more of the automatic screening and just yield an alarm. So it just takes time.
How much discretion does the TSA agent have when something goes through? Because, I mean, occasionally they will take something out and check it to see, you know, what exactly it is they're seeing. But are they locked into that process, or do you say, well, looks like kind of like a bottle of water, so I'm not going to worry about it? I mean, how does that process work?
They absolutely have discretion. I haven't gone through the training, so I don't know with exact detail, but they usually try to take a closer look or just open the bag up. And this is where we actually do want them to have a lot of good training, because we're trying to make a smaller haystack for them and have them focus on fewer dangerous things, but we have to make sure that they really resolve those false alarms. We hope they're false alarms. And so if there really is a true alarm or a true item that we should be concerned about, that they're actually finding it and not just waving their hands and saying, oh, it's probably, you know, a jar of jam and not an explosive. But so sometimes that's good, actually, when we hear about the jar of jam that caused a big issue at an airport. It means somebody's doing their job. Those don't happen a lot, but
you do hear occasionally, though, I believe, about, you know, guns going through and in the case of maybe a test, you know, and you'll
see
a little bit in the paper about, oh, yeah, you wouldn't believe what went through the scanner.
That's true. Those are never very fun to read, are they? In some cases, the the technology is designed to detect very specific things. So there's certain types of things they don't detect. And so that is often reported in the papers. And that's less concerning because I know the technology might be designed to detect this type of item. And of course, they got through. But we hope that the entire system, with the more layers we have, introduces deterrent effects and that people won't bother because, well, if it gets through security, it won't get through the next layer. And we've seen that the whole system seems to work pretty well. Airplanes seem to be a target, but we haven't seen too many incidents lately, knock on wood.
There was a kind of a chilling piece in the news not long ago, and I don't remember if it was Mosul or Raqqa or one of those other places where ISIS was removed, but there was actually an airport scanner there that they were obviously testing to see what they could get through and what they couldn't get through, which of course would prompt the TSA then to develop a different kind of scanner, but then you'd have to install it in every airport in the world.
Right, you don't have time to do that, but they absolutely, the terrorists can test and probe the system. This is going to be a weakness of any system that we have. And that's why the checkpoint screening can't be the end-all be-all of security.
Do you have the sense that it's the time that it takes to go through an airport? Do you have a sense that it's going to kind of move one way or the other? On the one hand, you can say, well, to test for all these things, it's just going to take more and more time because there are more and more ways to, create an explosive. But on the other hand, the screening will get more and more sophisticated. Do you foresee a point where it's actually going to somehow get sophisticated enough that people can walk onto a plane again just by passing through pretty quickly?
I don't see that in the near future. Mm-hmm. That would be great, wouldn't it? I don't like waiting in line. I love efficiency. But, whenever you have checkpoints, there are lines and there's some waiting. And so I think that's going to be a reality.
And we have how many flights a year that have to be screened?
A lot of flights. I know it's almost a billion passengers on these flights, so it's a lot.
So despite all the screening, it doesn't seem to have slowed down the air traffic that much, in terms of the quantity of it.
No, people are flying quite a bit.
All right, let's look at a scenario here. If I'm going to the airport and I want to get through as quickly as possible, I want to get through the whole screening system, get onto my plane and be on my way. How can I speed that process up just by not having checked luggage, not having carry-on, not having any luggage at all, wearing clothes that have no metal zippers or catches or anything? Is there a way to just totally slide through the system?
Yes, yes, and yes. All those things that you mentioned really make a difference. So just even having to take off a belt can slow things down, removing things from your pocket. I have a TSA approved laptop bags. So I don't have to take my laptop
off
and put it in a separate bin. So that's a big one. It's one fewer bin that goes on the conveyor belt there. But the big key is to look at the bottlenecks of a system. This is what I do whenever I'm in a system where I'm waiting in line. And the bottleneck is usually X-ray machine. And so trying to keep it moving, the conveyor belt full of items. And so sometimes people get distracted by having to take their shoes off and their belt off. And then that screener is idle. And that really just slows things down for everybody. So that's the tip. The other thing is if that passenger ahead of you needs a little help putting their bags through, maybe it's a sweet little old lady. You can help her out. That helps you out too.
Now, we started out with this whole thing about laptops and electronics, and where is that going in terms of what a person might be able to travel with?
Yeah, I just came back from overseas. I have some more overseas travel. I'm planning to bring my laptop with. I'm concerned about bans, but if you're actually looking at the ban, the rationale is that this could be a certain type of attack, and without technology, a ban, is one way to address it. But in this case, it's not really a uniform ban yet. It's just very targeted at a few countries, and there can be an easy workaround. And it might not be adding a whole lot of security with easy workarounds.
Well, kind of an obvious question, I guess, but if I'm a terrorist and I see that I can't bring in a laptop from Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, and Turkey and these other places, I'll just find a way to pick one up in Germany or France or Ethiopia or wherever.
Exactly.
So what does it really accomplish, do you think, to have those targeted bans like that?
Not as much as we'd like. It's better to have a more uniform policy, or at least, even if it's risk-based, we have some kind of laptop policy elsewhere to prevent this. And there's really no way. I mean, they can just, as you said, pick up a laptop somewhere else.
You know, I wonder sometimes about other parts of the airport. We're focused on getting to the gate and kind of the interior parts of the airport, but there are vast parts of airports where, for example, you claim your baggage, then anybody can walk in there and could come in off the street, pick up, correct me if I'm wrong, any suitcase and walk out and be unchallenged almost anywhere.
You're absolutely right. And there is security there. We talked about the bomb-sniffing dogs and just having security personnel there, but there's more. There's perimeter security at airports. So some airports even do random stops occasionally for people driving in.
Do they do that?
Yes, they do that. I know they do that at LAX, Los Angeles, and other places. Let's see. There's also things like random employee screening. There's checkpoints for the employees that work at these.
You got to wonder about that too, don't you? Yeah.
Exactly. And even when you're waiting in line, that's such a target, just having all those people there. The Brussels airport, the actual line for security where anybody can access that became a target. And so we don't want to create targets by through our security lines, right? So that's not really a good idea. And I think about this a lot, and you'll notice in some airports, they actually have the bulletproof glass near the security lines.
Do they?
So if there is an incident or if they find an explosive, all those people there are not then targets. So there are ways that they do secure. It takes a lot of time. It's a lot of infrastructure. It's a lot of good design that leads to some of this.
I gather then they can actually close off certain parts of the airport if there's a problem.
That is correct. So that's also why they need the guards there to help out if they're great. They can do a lot of different things if there's ever an incident or a suspected incident. And there's also a lot more security actually on the planes. We haven't talked too much about federal air marshals, mm-hmm. but it's not so tricky. It's a little bit tricky to get them onto the planes. So just like the crew, they have to fly around, but they have to get home eventually. And it's very complicated. Do you want them on the highest risk flights?
And these
so
are
on?
Always plain clothes.
They're plain
and
clothes
totally undercover, really.
Yes. And so it actually takes a lot of hardcore optimization power to figure out the best schedules and routes for those federal air marshals. And so they're there. We don't know that they're there because they just look like a regular passenger. But that's, one of the last lines of defense.
It seems to me at least airports over some other places that have been instituting security measures like, stadiums, that airports have the advantage of collecting a considerable amount of data on the people going through, whereas, somebody going to a football game, you don't know them from Adam.
That's true, and that allows us to have lower-risk passengers or TSA pre-check, but it's harder to in a stadium. But there is security in stadiums. It uses many of the same devices. They have metal detectors. There's a lot of manual bag inspection, of course. But whenever there are crowds, we want to have good security. And doing some of that inspection also leads to some behavioral detection that could be good if somebody's acting a little bit out of the ordinary. I know at college football games, they look for highly intoxicated students coming in. That's a major concern.
Can you even get onto a plane if you're intoxicated?
They know that's one of the reasons they can keep you off of a plane.
I've seen it done with buses, which surprised me. So I would think planes would be even more strict.
Right. They're pretty strict.
Well, it's going to be a future that all of us are going to be involved in, whichever way it goes. But obviously, it's going to get more and more sophisticated.
Right. And aviation security 5 years from now is going to look a lot different than it does today, just like our security today looks different than it did soon after September 11th and even 5 years ago.
Well, thank you for sharing your insights with us. My guest has been Laura Albert. She's a professor of industrial and systems engineering at the UW-Madison. And it's been very enlightening, and we'll all be keeping an eye on it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you'll be listening next time for University of the Air.